Welkom op de Ewin Think Tank.
Merhaba Think Tank, hoş geldiniz.
Dobro pozdravljajte na Think Tank.
Herzlich willkommen zum Ewin Think Tank. Es ist das. Ja.
That's all. I'm going to edit it all together with all the different languages.
Welcome to Ewin Marketing Podcast's Think Tank Rewind.
From June 16th, we'll be releasing themed episodes featuring interviews with our keynote speakers.
Dr. Karen Nelson Field and Rory Sutherland took to the stage at Think Tank for some truly fascinating insights into the field of marketing strategy and psychology.
And after their sessions, they joined Sam and I for a deeper conversation about decision-making, the nature of attention, behavioral psychology, and how it all applies to marketing strategy.
Let's go ahead and rewind the tape. There you go.
My name is Karen Nelson Field. I'm the founder of a business called Amplified, and we specialize in measurement of humans specifically through the lens of attention. So how do you pay attention to Facebook? How do you pay attention to Snapchat? How do you pay attention to, you know, feeds and stories? And that data is used for insights, but more importantly, product that can help you amplify your creative.
Karen, thanks so much for the presentation just
now.
It was great to hear your insights that have come off the back of your research. Now, you were making a kind of comparison between marketers and magicians in the presentation itself, which I thought was a nice vehicle for talking about what marketers do and the differences between those two actions and how they interact with audiences, because they're both trying to capture attention with audiences, right?
Yeah.
Do you think there's any magic in marketing today?
So I'll just step back and say the reason why I did that was because I felt that affiliate marketers are probably less aware of how traditional marketing works and what actually happens from an impression perspective. And so I felt like, you know, everyone gets the trick versus the reality thing. And I wanted to do that just to sort of try and help the audience understand the differences. Is there magic in marketing? I think it's a lot more data-driven now than ever. I think there are still clever creatives out there that can, I call it the double win, that they know what formats to use, but more importantly, how to, you know, serve something that's emotive or surprising or different to an audience, which is rare. So it's the double win.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about the way marketing works now, it's the sea of sameness. So if you've ever seen any of the blanding kind of conversations, essentially marketers have scaled down their creative, scaled down difference to fit within what they think is what digital is all about. But there is few people that do double wins.
Are there any examples that you can think of?
The one that I use a lot, which is from the VCCP agency, right? So I've even written about that in the book. The meerkat.
Compare the market.
I call that the trio of triggers, the perfect trio of triggers. So emotions, cues, repetition, and the way they use that little fairy thing. Alexander. And how consistent that is and how emotional it is. We all know who it is. There's no way you'd misattribute that. The other one I think is a really clever marketing organization is Specsavers.
Oh, yes.
They specialize in unexpectedness.
Yeah.
So unexpectedness are things that you had to look at twice because you did not expect that. Your brain just naturally is wired to think one way. So Specsavers, I think, are a really excellent example of consistency of brand, because that's really important, but being able to flip it so that you know should have gone to
Are you aware of that brand, Sam? Because it's a UK-based one.
So I knew that. So that I know that they've only just landed in the US recently.
Okay.
So they're not big there. They, I think they even don't have a physical
But it'll be interesting to see, though, now does this translate.
I mean, they've got a lot of work to do because there's a new country with zero recognition of their brand. But fortunately, it's a cut-through type of ad. So they do a really good job.
It is a challenge I think we see a lot with brands that we work through in different markets, and whether they want to enter an emerging market or more specifically, you know, we work with a lot of UK brands that then want to enter the US, which is a massive geographic region and a very established market, of like, how do they break through that narrative and how do they like stand out of that sea of sameness, whether it's with traditional advertising or with affiliate. But I think, Rob, I don't know if you would agree, sometimes affiliate gives a bit of a competitive edge to that brand, because in some aspects it's like taking the thinking out of their heads and it's really just kind of like shifting it onto the publisher and speaking to like their audience.
I asked you a question actually at the end of the session around like the value of trust in advertising. And obviously, that's not something that you can necessarily measure with the assessments that you do.
Yeah.
But speaking to kind of going into new markets as a brand, where you have affiliates, publishers, creators, influencers who have a ready-made audience who already trust them, it becomes a kind of ready-made launchpad almost for a brand to be introduced to that
They're
audience.
They're like a whole reach ecosystem within the bigger, wider, fragmented world, right?
Yeah.
So my first book years ago was on content diffusion and the math behind viral. In the early days, influencers weren't there and affiliate wasn't a thing, but you know, I studied the math that sits behind seeding and then diffusion of views and shares and things like that. So it was kind of, even in those days, you needed, I guess, an ecosystem of reach for content to fly. So if I think about it, that's like 15 or 16 years ago, it's still the same. So I look at it in that way. But also, I think affiliate, even if you can't prove trust, don't underplay relevance.
Mm.
And relevance is different to a lot of people. So it could be the product they're using is relevant, but it also could be the lifestyle they lead is relevant and resonant. Relevance is what we call an attention amplifier, and we've seen that in some of the influencer work that we've tested. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Context matters to that point, right? And contextual display seems to be having a resurgence, partly I think from privacy perspectives and the tracking that goes on there, but that feels like something that would have a positive impact upon attention spans.
So it's the right place, right time. Yeah. It's not, so it's context.
Well, I think that speaks really well too to like how we see from an affiliate perspective how consumers shop and how there's now an affiliate partner to like work with the consumer based on where they are in their shopping journey, whether they're in that exploratory phase or they're finally ready to make a purchase. You know, we work with some companies too that help convert traffic at the point of sale or retain that business after the fact. So it is a lot of like leveraging these data moments and these context and touch points and trust and culmination, all of it to push towards whatever your desired outcome is.
You know, that's
is.
So real. Like, you know, there's a whole lot of research around what they call recency theory, which basically says that you are most susceptible to buy when you're close to the purchase occasion, or you're in the market to buy and you're close to the purchase occasion. So the problem with, generally speaking, from a privacy perspective, you don't really know when someone's in that market because you don't know how I'm feeling at the time, except I guess you have other triggers of that. But no, absolutely, you're speaking about things that have been known in marketing for a very long time.
From a media buying perspective at the moment, there's a direction of travel towards more automated solutions. So you've got Performance Max, obviously, you've got Advantage Plus, I think Meta have. What's your take on that as a general trend?
What I've learned with love and respect is when they're making a change to it because what they've done hasn't worked. So what they'll do is that it'll just move more towards black box and non-transparency. So I feel not particularly confident in it. So what I've learned about publishers of similar ilk is that they will push you to the inventory that best serves their commercial gain. So I'm not convinced, even if in the spirit of AI, which is supposed to be extremely valuable, which we know it is, I'm not convinced that it's the most efficient or the most effective, particularly for new buyers. I think you're probably just going to pull sales up from people that have already, were going to buy it anyway. So there's a whole efficiency play, I think, that's problematic in that.
And thinking about AI, like the other side of it is around creation of creative. And that suddenly democratizing force around the fact that anybody now can create images on Sora or copy on via ChatGPT or something like this. Does that mean it becomes even more difficult to stand out because of that abundance?
Gen AI particularly produces very similar content. So I think it'll improve over time. But yeah, I'm skeptical around the uniqueness of the content and how distinctive it's going to be by comparison to everyone else who's using similar formats. On one hand, though, I also think the good creators are ingesting data that supports how to improve that creative in real time when someone's looking or not looking. So I see the future being, you know, creative optimization using data that describes the viewing experience. So both sides, media and creative, I see that unification coming.
Versus now saying, I want to do this and like create me something. It's almost becoming more of a crutch than it is an enabler at the moment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the next, not generation after me, but the generation after that are the ones that are going to kind of work out how to do it properly.
Yeah. You know, obviously you are very passionate about data. We are very passionate about data. But going back to these magic moments that we were talking about earlier, do you feel like we can sometimes set ourselves up in a trap of being like so reliant on the data that we kind of cut ourselves off from having that natural creative process?
Look, I think that's a really good question. Yes and no. The scale of the data we have is so vast that we see patterns, so I can predict it within an inch of our lives. But the beautiful thing about what we do see in certain formats is there's an opportunity or a stage, right? There's a window of opportunity. So classic case in point. So last week did a piece of work and we saw that the variation between platform A and platform D in terms of how much attention was lost is about 60%. Mm. But there's still 30% that sits between best and worst creative. Mm. I think what we don't do well enough is we don't still focus on effectiveness within that, right? So there is still stuff you can do to make it. So you want both. You want really good creative to get as much attention as you can given the constraints of the format, if that makes sense. So I think, to your point, when you are data-driven and, you know, 3 seconds is the average, you don't sort of think, well, let's try for five, even though that's as far as we can go, but it's still an extra 2 seconds.
And I think, too, like, creativity can mean a lot of things. It's like, how creative can you get within those 3 seconds, or is there creativity pushing that, like, time frame in itself?
Yeah. No, we can do a lot with 5 seconds.
Yeah.
I'm Rory Sutherland. I'm the vice chairman of Ogilvy. I'm the author of Alchemy. And I've been doing a keynote to these lovely folks here in the world of affiliate marketing. I've always been a huge fan of the product without necessarily knowing how it works behind the scenes. Mm. So this has been, I hope, as illuminating to me as a conference as I've been to the audience.
Something that actually came up in your presentation where you had said that to economists, it's a number, and to consumers,
it's a feeling.
It's a feeling. And, you know, the affiliate marketing industry is B2B, or really B2B2C marketing.
It is.
Do you think that this sentiment still holds true in B2B or B2B2C marketing?
Oh, that's a good question. I always say that fundamentally the decisions taken are kind of emotional. In B2B, the emotion is slightly different. And I always say in B2C, people are trying to minimize the risk of regret. Mm-hmm. And in B2B, they're trying to minimize the risk of blame. Mm.
Yeah.
There is a different psychology going on in B2B decisions. Most B2C decisions, you don't have to justify yourself with a 7-page PowerPoint deck whenever you choose a particular brand of toothpaste. Okay, You're not required to go through that level of self-defense. Mm. And you're allowed to act on your instincts and your intuition. And in B2B, there's always that secondary question. If this goes wrong, how do I defend myself? I need, therefore, even if it's reverse engineered, a seemingly logical route by which I arrived at this decision in order to make the decision fundamentally, immune to criticism.
Is this the arse covering dressed as rigor that you were referencing a couple of times?
The downside of that, you know, if you take no one ever got fired for buying IBM, which is that old mantra, okay? Yeah. The downside of it, undoubtedly, is that there's an awful lot of activity in business which isn't really designed to change the nature of the decision taken. Mm. It's to create a rational superstructure to justify the decision in the event that it leads to criticism. Mm. And so you might argue that, you know, as human beings, as ordinary consumers, we don't need to do this, which sometimes I think occasionally means we make worse decisions. Mm. But on the other hand, we don't waste a spectacular amount of time constructing a kind of bogus post-rationalization for everything we do.
Yeah. You started off talking about bees.
Yeah.
And the waggle dance and the 80-20 kind of dynamic there in terms of efficiency. And you got this 20% of the...
20% explore, 80% exploit.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a practice taken in advertising, you've probably come across it, which is sometimes called 70-20-10.
Yeah.
What always happens, and this is the problem, is under any kind of constraint, it's the 10 that gets cut first. Mm-hmm. And in the short term, of course, that makes sense, because generally the most experimental 10% of what you do often pays back a bit more slowly than the 70. Mm. However, over a time of certainly years rather than quarters, if you stop doing the 10, there are all kind of costs you end up paying.
Yeah.
They're just not quite as salient.
Yeah.
I mean, the vital problem is an opportunity cost. No one ever gets bollocked for missing an opportunity.
Mm.
Okay, so opportunity costs are much safer in a corporate world than costs.
Yeah.
And consequently, I would argue that, yes, I think businesses are probably particularly those constrained by sort of the need to justify their existence quarter by quarter, I think they are effectively overweighted towards exploit and underweighted towards explore. Mm. And for the same reason of justification, I think nearly all businesses are overweighted in terms of acquisition effort and underweighted in terms of customer service and retention, simply because the former is faster, more quantifiable, more attributable, and easier to justify, I think, than the latter.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're something like a bank, let's say you invest in a very clever customer service initiative, in terms of the effect on retention, it might take you years, you know, to actually arrive at the data that justified the activity.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we've got to learn to do is sometimes there are activities where you just have to lower the barrier to proof. Yeah. Make the burden of proof a little less burdensome, because the wonderful guy John Roberts, who founded AO, you know, if their kid's in the house and they're delivering a washing machine, they give the kids a branded Bear.
Yeah.
Well, as he said, am I really going to demand a precise, granular return on investment for that? I mean, you could do it. You could have a control group where you don't give them a Bear, you know, and you could measure the effect on repeat purchase and retention over time. But his argument is, look, some ideas are just good ideas. Yeah. You know, in other words, they're just talkable enough and interesting enough to justify the cost without necessarily needing to drill down into the precise and immediate return.
It's something that almost has to come from the founder or the CEO, because they're the ones that have the license to go off and do something left field without the justification necessarily.
Yeah, so, I mean, historically, within departments, people had a reasonable amount of discretionary, you know, budget. And I don't think that exists anymore. No. I think that's a problem, actually, which is that if you look at innovations, as many of them come from the bottom up as come from the top down. And if you don't allow acts of minor mischief and insubordination at the lower levels of your organization, then you'll never make those bottom-up discoveries.
Yeah.
You know, we can look empirically at the history of scientific discovery and go, it's actually people on the coalface noticing things who are almost more likely to come up with the next penicillin than people who have a plan.
People that know Rob and I quite well often joke that he's the ideas man and I'm the organized one. He might say that I would say all of his ideas are irrational, but I would love to ask you, what is one irrational idea you think every single marketer should try?
Well, the first thing is just actually is the process you arrive at for having ideas, which often starts with simply noticing an anomaly. Roger L. Martin has three things he thinks give rise to most, not all, but most creative strategies, which are analogy, anomaly, and trade-offs. And so the trick to the creative act, which seems irrational, is to take something which everybody assumes is a trade-off. There's a trade-off between price and quality. There's a trade-off between X and Y. And actually, what you find is that everybody just treats that as a given, as if it's kind of Newtonian law. You might argue, okay, sometimes technology means that what used to be a trade-off no longer is. The Uber map is the example I always give, okay? Yeah. Which is actually, if you give people good information about where their taxi is and when it's turning up, they're not that bothered if it arrives 5 minutes later or 5 minutes sooner, okay? What they don't like is the uncertainty, it's not the duration. And in quite a lot of cases, I think there are assumptions made. I mean, the Moxie Hotel is an interesting, very interesting case in point, which just goes, okay, we're going to focus less and less on the rooms because the fun, party-loving folks in a good location in town who are the intended target audience, they'll be out doing things, so the room is less important to them, but the communal areas are more important. So what we're going to do is we're going to zig when everybody else zags. There's a problem in business, which I sort of hinted at the beginning of my talk, when I talked about the need for comparison. So one of the things that worries me in B2B is that procurement kill innovation, because any really significant innovation is not going to be like-for-like comparable with what you might call your standard shortlist of established suppliers, okay? So if you come up with a better idea and you say, actually, the solution to this isn't to build a tram line, it's e-bikes, they basically reject this because their argument is, I need to compare three tram providers so I can compare them on price. And you say, but you don't need trams at all. And they go, yes, but then you're bound to win because e-bikes are cheaper than trams. So I can't add you to the shortlist, despite the fact that your solution may be inordinately superior, okay, because you're not directly comparable. But innovations generally are innovations because they're not directly comparable. If you compared the iPhone to the Nokia or the Motorola phone that was dominant at that time, and you'd compared it not on the basis of usability, but on the basis of the spec, you would have said the battery life is shit. Okay. The first iPhone had appalling... I don't know, you're not old enough to remember this. Okay?
I am.
You are just about, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So the first iPhone, it barely made it to lunchtime.
Yeah.
But people liked it so much, they were happy buying a huge bulbous case with a battery in it or taking a charger to work, and they just found a workaround.
Yeah.
Now, most innovations will often be slightly inferior in one dimension, but massively superior in another dimension. But if that dimension isn't actually part of your procurement kind of, what would it be, you know, shortlist, list of criteria, or, you know, key performance indicators, then you're going to get thrown out. And so it really does worry me in the extent to which B2B innovation is, I think, sometimes being really destroyed by the need to go through a process, which should be a flexible process, but has actually turned into a kind of, you know, almost a ritual.
It's kind of a committee-based kind of decision-making process, isn't it? It's interesting from an affiliate perspective because we've often tried to frame what affiliates do, and Adam talked about this in his keynote, this idea of like decentralizing innovation and authenticity. Because if you're a brand and you own all of your in-house assets and you're controlling that image and how it's distributed across the ad ecosystem, what affiliates are offering you is something a little bit different, because you're basically saying, here's, you know, the keys to my brand. You're the one that owns the relationship with an audience, and I'm having to trust you to articulate that in the way that you feel is best.
Was, obviously, this is at a much broader scale. This was similar to the extent in, you know, old traditional advertising when a brand chose a celebrity spokesman.
Exactly.
You know, there was always the risk, that, by the way, you'd have to insure against them getting into some hideous scandal.
Yeah. That's happened in the past, right?
Which has emphatically happened.
Yeah.
That's why, actually, you know, cartoon characters were so desirable because, you know, they didn't have a life outside the page. It's also a very intelligent thing to do, by the way, which is I always think that brand partnerships and affiliations are, in a way, should be the first port of call, particularly for a business trying to innovate. Now, there is an issue which I worry about, which is that generally, because of the need to justify cost with acquisition, it does a great job for products that have a high lifetime value, credit card, say, or a bank account, or, you know, the adoption of some, you know, signing up to Candy Crush, whatever it may be, okay? It has a great, great thing for high margin products as well. It has a great thing for products that are bought on impulse, you know, online.
Okay?
The only thing that does concern me about it is an unrepresentative sample of the marketplace, in that one of the points I've made to quite senior people in advertising is I go, look, I spend quite a lot of money on Unilever and P&G products, and they are in fact among the largest advertisers in the world. Okay. But I never see any online ads personally for P&G or Unilever products, packaged goods, FMCG. In other words, things that aren't attributable because you buy them through a shop are going to lose out. Things that are low margin but, you know, relatively frequent purchase, fast-moving consumer goods, are going to lose out. And I had this, you know, strange thing where I bought... My daughters went to school, and they kept laddering their tights because they were required to wear tights as part of their school uniform. And a friend of my wife said, look, buy them really expensive tights because they do last significantly longer, and also because they're expensive, they'll take better care of them. So I went online to one of these premium manufacturers, and I barely saw advertising for anything else.
Really?
And it suddenly occurred to me, okay, their margin is going to be about 90%.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an impulse buy, okay? It's not like a car purchase, and it's hugely attributable, and these people are buying direct from us rather than through a retailer, so we're getting twice as much margin. And therefore, it made sense to them to advertise to me almost ad infinitum, because I only had to make one incremental purchase to pay for 10,000 impressions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas a shampoo brand can't do that.
Mm.
Now, in many ways, for example, retailers looking to acquire new loyal customers, this is fantastic. It's fantastic, as I said, for high margin or niche products. It's brilliant for products people didn't know existed. Okay, I'm always going to see more luxury goods advertising, okay, than I am for... you know, I don't know, hemorrhoid cream, or unless they target me very precisely.
Maybe there's a luxury version of it.
There are always going to be some categories which advertise a lot more because they're highly image dependent. But the only thing that worries me about online advertising is that a really good media ecosystem, I roughly see ads for things in proportion to where the contents of my wallet go. Mm-hmm. And it's worth noting that we haven't really got that online. Mm. I don't think we had that on TV either.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that was disproportionately the other way around.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could argue the two are actually complementary. It depends what category you're in, to what extent, you know, how you're bought. I mean, the earlier advertisers made a very, very, very good distinction. You know, there's a massive distinction between acquiring a new American Express Platinum Card member and, you know, and obviously, you know, selling jam on a one-off trial basis, mm-hmm. okay? But I do wonder, I do worry a bit that there's a kind of imbalance at work.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, along with entities like Shopify, for example, and Klarna, they are doing a wonderful job to diversify and variegate online retail. Mm. And I suspect that we'll actually see what we see as two long tails.
Yeah.
Mm. In other words, it is a long-tailed market. And there is going to be a sort of fat tail of smaller retailers serving niches.
Yeah. We often kind of think about when we're talking about affiliates is that you've got that kind of nicheification phenomenon that is almost part and parcel of the internet. People have been able to find their communities in ways that maybe in the past they weren't able to.
Personal recommendation is inherently powerful provided the person has reputational skin in the game. If someone recommends something which they've been paid to recommend, does it mean the thing they're recommending is the best thing you could possibly buy? Don't know. Mm. However, it's worth noting that a lot of the time when consumers make a purchase, I always make this point, McDonald's isn't the most successful restaurant in the world because it's really, really good. Mm. However, it is really, really good at not being bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? You know, you're not going to get ripped off. The food's going to be pretty tasty. You're not going to get the shits. The toilets are going to be okay. Your kids are going to be safe. Okay? Right. There are a hell of a lot of not negatives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we as marketers tend to focus on adding the positives. And actually, the bigger gain is often to be found removing negatives, removing fear, uncertainty, doubt. Who the hell are these people?
Yeah.
And a recommendation from someone who needs to maintain their own credibility is going to be an 8.
Yeah. We see that with like different creators too. And a lot of creators I follow, for every like one paid ad recommendation that they give, they'll do 4, 5, 10, because they want their audience to trust them and know that they're not going to endorse necessarily a product that they're going to.
By the way, I'm delighted to see Shark Ninja here. And I do feel deep down that they owe me at least a free air fryer. Because what is weirdly true, you can go and research this on YouTube. I was basically the world's first air fryer advocate.
Really?
Really?
So
I was probably the second.
You were the second.
So, No.
I don't have one.
And by the way,
we gotta fix this.
Don't listen to those people who go, it's just a small convection oven.
It's not. Right. It's the best kitchen appliance I've ever bought in my entire life.
Thank you. And also, if you think about it, a convection oven is simply a ridiculously large and inefficient air fryer.
Yes.
So let's reframe that, because how often do you cook a whole turkey, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the air fryer is, as you said, the best thing. And what I noticed was that pretty much 80% of people who bought an air fryer became air fryer evangelists. Most of us have a few products we'd be very happy to evangelize because they are genuinely so good that you're doing someone a favor by recommending it. I think many things lend themselves to affiliate marketing, which are what economists call experience goods, which is you don't really know how good it is until you've tried it. Once you've tried it, you become a kind of weird swivel-eyed convert, you know, practically sort of, you know, going door to door. And so there are many, many things, I think, which only really can be sold that way, through a person's genuine enthusiasm for the experience. Mm. There's no coincidence that Shark Ninja here today in force, because, I mean, they are a brand created by affiliate marketing, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think we ought to be talking about this more. Is this actually the future of how you create a brand? Mm. And actually, we should all be looking to Shark Ninja for lessons on how it's done. Who are your favorite clients in terms of the, you know, users of great affiliate marketing? Who?
Can we answer that?
Yeah.
This
is not an exclusive question.
Yeah.
But who are some of your favorite?
When you're talking about big global enterprise brands, like it's the likes of Samsung, Shark Ninja, a lot of them who are obviously attending the conference. And they've just been very open to working with lots of different types of partners and ad models. And it's not simply a case of, like, you know, being happy to just do a bit of cashback over here or a discount code over there or maybe one or two media partners.
Samsung, in weaning people off the sheep-like devotion to the iPhone, which is not based on any rational...
No. Well, that's brand, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's social pressure. My daughter had, for a time, the top-of-the-range Windows phone, which had been given to me, actually, at a conference.
Okay.
And I already had a new phone, and she broke her iPhone, and she gave her this thing. And she admitted to me that the interface was the nicest mobile phone interface interface of any interface.
Oh, wow.
However, all her friends at school thought she was weird.
Yeah.
And every time she took it out, she had to explain, okay? If you think about Coca-Cola, you never have to explain why you want a Coca-Cola,
no.
Okay? Whereas if I go to a place and say, have you got a Dr. Pepper, right? Unless you're in Texas or New Mexico, you're going to be treated as a weirdo.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that's nothing to do with the product. It's entirely to do with the social context within which the product is used. So for Samsung, I'm a huge devotee. Now, they can never do this, but they should. I think these folding phones are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, actually, there's a very, very good reason I bought this, which they can never say, I'm old. I can't fucking see. Okay? So you can't market this as an old person's phone.
Yeah, yeah, okay? Yeah.
But actually, you could have an elderly influencer, obviously be, you know, advertising to reasonably prosperous old people because these things aren't cheap.
Yeah.
But they are utterly fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There are USPs, which is the old advertising thing. That's a unique selling proposition, which is true to everybody, okay? The promise you make to everybody. But particularly in the tech world, there are actually what I call ISPs, which are individual selling propositions. Yeah. But the individualized selling proposition is, well, most people may not want one of these, but in your case, it's a particularly good buy because your eyesight's a bit fun because you're 59 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you know, obviously in mass media, you're never going to sell a Galaxy Z Fold 6 thingy, okay, on the basis that it's great for people whose eyesight's a bit dicky. But there's a whole subcategory there, undoubtedly.
The ISP thing, I think, is that maybe something that only becomes economically viable when you have something like e-commerce and online? Because going back to that thing of, you know, you're talking about fragmented niche consumers, but then suddenly, if you've got all of those niches aggregated over a massive geographic space, i.e., you know, the planet, suddenly it becomes economically viable in a way that it wouldn't have done if
you were
a localized.
I totally agree with you. Yeah.
Producer,
So that's true of manufacturing. To some extent, true of distribution. You know, as distance isn't that relevant. The famous thing, of course, in nicheism, okay, which you'll probably get edited out, is the famous phrase: "There's porn for that." Okay, you should have been in that. Once you have an audience of 6 billion people, no weird fetish is too bizarre for you to be entirely alone. So this is in some ways the retail equivalent of, you know, there's a retailer for that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of our Think Tank Rewind mini-series.
Tune back in tomorrow for a chat about the past, present, and future of Awin and the wider affiliate industry.
Don't forget to subscribe to our feed. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also visit awin.com/podcast for more great audio content, including our main podcast series.
Yes, do check out the episodes from our main series where we speak to a variety of top brands and their partners about why affiliate partnerships are a win-win for them all. See you next time.